Hey everybody, welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins, where we talk about The Wandering Inn with me and Dragonus.
Howdy everybody, I'm Dragonus.
I forgot how to do the intro. This is how you know 3 weeks of working straight at like 60, 70 hours a week is not a good idea on top of everything else.
Melts your brain.
I'm planning to take 4 days off after Tuesday. So I will have short break, but yeah, it was interesting couple of weeks. Last week, at this point, I think the AMA has announced all the TWI news. You want to talk about it?
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. Pirate doesn't do this kind of thing very often, so it's going to be really cool.
I hope they actually answer questions, because just, let's be honest, Pirate holds things close to their chest, and they don't like people commenting on shit. So, or maybe they do like, I don't know. I honestly don't know. Pirate is a confusing enigma of choices. But we'll see if we get any tidbits. For anybody who's listening who goes to the ACD stuff, I'll hold a little public event for everybody to like recap what happened at the AMA and just chat about things that came out and what speculations, assuming Pirate drops any little tidbits. Andrea's going to be at the AMA too, so there's a bunch of questions there for me.
Oh, yeah, true.
Speaking of Andrea, did you listen to the thing that she did with Pirate this weekend?
I did not. I did not even know that she did a thing with Pirate this weekend.
Yeah, the Wandering in AMA announcement. Go check it out. And it's like she did a voice recording of a script that Pirate wrote up, and there was like, just, you have to watch it to see it. It's just very cute and very, like, it's nice. It's like a pre-AMA with Aaron answering questions.
God. That's the only AMA I think I might actually want more than a pirate AMA, is just an Aaron AMA. Just, like, reverse, triple, reach around, isekai her into our world for, like, an afternoon, answer some questions on Reddit, and then back to the inn you go.
You know what? That's not a bad idea. Maybe we can write up a script and see if Andrea was willing to do it. It'll be fan fiction.
Oh, God, no. That would be the worst idea.
Okay. I did have, like, a few couple of things. I'm keeping it to TWI stuff because my real life stuff is just, like, too much, and I don't want to talk about it. So, there was a video that was recently released by Phil Time, Dragonus, while I look things up. I'm not prepared today.
Ah, well, if I have to fill some time randomly and unexpectedly, I lost about 5 hours of my life this weekend to this new video game, Stray. It is exactly as adorable as it looks, but it's also, like, well-written and fun. Go play it. Fun indie games deserve money.
I have to see Iron Mouse play Stray. And I think Connor Dog, C-Dog VA, is also going to do it, so I'm going to watch him play it. Because I can't do it. If I sit down, I think I'm going to get obsessed with this thing. I found the video. So it's by a booktuber named Patrick Leo. I think I said his name right. And he did a video called The Biggest Fantasy Series / Universes of All Time Is Not What You Think It Is. And the top one is The Wandering Inn.
Ooh.
Yeah, I think it's based off that chart that came off a couple of months ago, weeks ago, whatever. And I've gotten hard trying to convince him to go read The Wandering Inn. in the comments, not like anything else.
I'll have to check that out. What'd you say the name of it was again?
Here, let me give you the link.
Well, no, I ask you what the name of it is again, so you say it again out loud for the listeners.
The Biggest Fantasy Series / Universes of All Time Is Not What You Think It Is by Patrick Leo, P-E-T-R-I-K, and Leo. He's a book talk. I keep saying book talker because I'm so used to book talk, but it's booktuber. There's like so many really good booktubers who give really good recommendations. And honestly, BookTube has replaced the once vibrant blogger community. Because there used to be blogs everywhere that would track all the fantasy releases. And me being really, really lazy, I love that because then I didn't have to go look. And instead, I would just trawl through the book blogs, figure out what's good, make a little list, and go buy the ones that I enjoyed.
Yeah, no, I do rather like BookTube. I actually know Patrick Leo stuff. I've listened to him before. I'm a big Crimson Rogue fan. specifically, actually. Something about like review shows with goofy, entirely awful, yet somehow entertaining meta plots just works for me. I blame Linkara.
There's actually a booktuber that I enjoy. It's not a fantasy booktuber. And I think it's just because I'm jealous of him. Again, names, not great. Oshi, big news. But he's like got a million followers. He does really nice booktube videos. And he's queer and he lives in France. And he gets to work for a publishing thing. I think it's Jack Edwards. That's his name. And he does all these popular like booktuber stuff and things that come off Twitter and all these lists and things. But he's actually reasonably charming. And I'm super jealous because I wish at his age I was able to live in Paris and work for a publishing company.
Yeah, that does seem like the dream.
Oh God, what a dream. Anyway. Okay, we're getting off the beaten track for this. I talked about this booktube stuff. Oh, we didn't even talk about what the video says about the Wandering Inn.
Oh, no, we didn't. What did it say about the Wandering Inn?
Nothing. That's the thing. He's never read it before. He just knows that the length is there and he knows very little about it. And I was like, that's. And his exact response was that it's such a niche thing that there just isn't. He trawled through the internet looking for information about the Wandering Inn and he barely found anything. And you know what? I blame Pirate. I blame Pirate. It's the truth. Pirate Abbott does not market. They do of everything to avoid attention while writing this massive work that's wonderful. This is a criminal offense.
Word of mouth speaks for itself, Oshi. And I say this because it's kind of funny. Somebody on a forum that I frequent actually posted up saying, "Hey, I saw we had a thread about Wandering Inn." And then I looked at it and I realized this is like three times the length of Game of Thrones and has positive reviews. Can someone explain to me what the hell is going on? And you realize there is no way to properly really explain the Wandering Inn. It's too much. I don't even know how I would market it, other than
I
like.
do. I do. I do.
All right.
It is a non-traditional web serial that's designed to be episodic in nature with a structure that has overarching plots but focuses in on day-to-day life at times. The typical tagline should
And you've lost me.
be slice of life war crimes.
Okay, so open with slice of life war crimes, because the rest of that was the kind of thing that I think, like, marketing-wise, you're going to lose people's attention trying to explain all that, because it is so much story.
I would have started with the slice of life war crimes, and then I would have gone into a spiel about how it is. Because the big problem that I have is that there's this discordance between expectations and reality. TWI is a web serial. It's designed to be a web serial. It's written every week. The size of it is because of Pirate Abbott's skill at writing. And no, it is not filler because it's designed to work in the structure of the web serial. It's not supposed to be filler. There's a point to everything.
I also dislike people's overuse of the phrase filler. For me, filler is an incredibly specific concept, and not everything that fails to advance a quote-unquote main plot is automatically filler. Sometimes establishing characters, or establishing the setting, or helping create a status quo so we can shake it up later, all of those are things that are done in quote-unquote filler episodes that really shouldn't be called filler.
Yeah, and the idea of using the medium of web serials and the fact that you're not stuck with the it has to be plotted perfectly, paced perfectly, and done at this spot and finished at that spot, and every story has to have a point of view and it has to be very fast and snappy and good, which is what all of these published the three publishing companies in New York City that ran everything for the past 60 years have decided is the only way to write a book. They're the ones who decided it was the only way to write a book. Not that there weren't other ways to write one.
I mean, it's usually a pretty solid plan, right? Like, it's not like they're talking completely out their asses about what does or doesn't make a good book. It's just very restrictive towards experimentation in format, and the less people experiment in format, the less likely they are to find ways to do things that don't involve the big publishing companies. Huh, what an odd coincidence.
Oh. Yeah, I could never figure out why they would want to create these standards. And the worst part of it is, if you look at, say, like East Asian literature, but since their publishing core isn't as like deep in terms of age, and instead they developed in the new age with the internet and stuff, they're far more tolerant of experimental and variations and structure and like the mediums being more internet based than it is like very structured three act plays. I hate that. We could go on a rant for this for like hours.
Oh, yeah. Although, God, that does remind me. I remember when I was in high school back in the aughts, and I had heard that there was this crazy thing the Japanese were doing where they were texting you a story on your phone, like a chapter at a time. And I'm like, that's so weird. I wonder how they can even read something that tiny on their phones. That just feels like a headache. I don't know if that's going to catch on. Me being terribly wrong.
I mean, yeah, it's just the whole last thing.
The iPhone changed the game, though. That was back in the flip phone era, so,
I mean, they didn't have flip phones like we do. That's the thing. They had phones with decent screens. We didn't get those until like 5 years after Japan got them. Japan still uses fax for everything, but they somehow also have hyper advanced handheld phones about 10 years before everybody else does.
Oh, tons of people still use fax for everything. Like, I have to help people order a lot of fax lines for businesses. It still gets used a lot. It's just a standard.
It's not the only standard, is my point. It's not the, like, you have to use fax lines for everything. Email and integrate, and other mediums are integrated as part of that. Fax lines aren't just, okay, let's not get lost into the fax line.
Yeah, let's not get down another tangent, but while we're talking a whole bunch about books, Oshi, you mentioned we had a reader email asking us to talk more about books.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly an email, it was more like a comment on Discord. And I was talking to a bunch of people, and they were like, I'd love to hear more about your opinions about books and things. Before we even get into that, actually, we should probably read the one reader email we got and announce that the reader emails will come when they come, because at this point, I am done asking questions that people can answer. Nobody's answering them, and it's not worth our time.
Yeah, no, engagement isn't super up on it. And I'll admit, we could probably ask better questions, but then I'd have to think about it ahead of time, and thinking's not my strong suit, so.
Anyway, Landray emails us. Hi, nice to have Dragoness back from the almost dead fun episode. So what kind of clown would I be? Well, obviously, Oshi is the best clown, fuck you. But if I really had to choose, I'd say a juggalo, since I have horrible anxiety. I feel I'm standing out in any way. If I have to walk around looking like a complete tit, I shall need to be on a metric fuckton of mind-altering substances for which the aforementioned clowns are well known. All the best, elaborate. Yeah.
Juggalos are great.
Yeah, that sounds about good. Just being high all the fucking time.
I've known a lot of juggalos. They're actually pretty decent people, very community oriented, very high at all times, prone to random bouts of like violence because somebody talked shit or they thought somebody talked shit and everybody's too high to stay calm about it, but pretty cool people.
So going back to the subject that we were starting on, but again tangented into the reader email and our sudden announcement, we are going to try something else. Instead of asking you to answer our questions, we're just going to talk about books. Like whatever book we like, old, new, in between, generational divides, whatever the fuck we want, we're going to spend 15 minutes talking about it. And I don't care if it takes up too much of time, it makes the episode longer. I want to talk about books.
Oh, Oshi has made a decision. Let's talk about books.
Yeah, let's do it. You picked out a book to talk about this week, right?
I less picked out a book than I sort of fell down a hole on an old series I hadn't read in a long while and wanted to read again. Are you familiar at all with David Weber or the Hunter Harrington series?
Honor Harrington's? You mean Honor Harrington series? Yes, I do.
Her name is literally pronounced Honor, like Honor. I don't know how you could mispronounce Honor, Oshi.
You mispronounced honor. I was making fun of you. You said honor. Who the hell is honor? All right. Don't be mean to me. Hello?
I'm here. Go on.
Ooh, okay.
All right.
I was giving you space to continue to talk. Oh my god. See, Dragnus tricks me with his silence. He's just waiting for me to like keep talking.
this book does have something of a content warning. There are some pretty violent and depraved acts that are committed by some of the villains in it. Some of them of the sexual variety, some of them just of the brutal execution variety. Nothing is ever described in detail, but it is there and it is treated very seriously, so keep an eye out for it. It's a military science fiction series by Bane Books, with not as bad as some other stuff from Bane Books can get. As a publishing house, there's really no way to talk about them without mentioning they have something of a bit more of a conservative bent. But for the most part, the David Weber has always been good in keeping it in his metaphorical pants when it comes to politics stuff. But it's about giant spaceships that, for a large number of very detailed and contrived reasons, have to line up like old school warships do and fire at each other with broadsides, because this is Horatio Hornblower in space and he's really committed to the bit.
What I remember about the series wasn't necessarily the military aspects of it, even though it's heavily, there are entire chapters where it's just a description of a fucking battle. Chapter after chapter detailing every movement and the
Oh yeah.
pulse of weapons and the death of people. Like, it can get pretty.
It can get really intense. Like when he has a good battle scene going, you feel it. Actually, also the specific book I want to talk about, the second one, has probably one of my favorite chapters in all of science fiction. It's about the life of a missile, and it just describes how the missiles of the series work in detail as it tracks a single missile that miraculously makes it through to destroy an enemy ship at a key moment. And it's just fucking hilarious and kind of poignant and informative in a way that doesn't make you feel like you're being lectured about the technology.
It never really appealed to. So I read David Weber's book when I was, I think, just at the cusp of starting college, like 17 or so or something like that. And I finished the whole series up to then, and I continued with the Armor Harrington series because it had a nice bent into it where it respected women, it had actual interesting characters that I enjoyed, and it had tree cats. And on top of that, it seemed to introduce, or at least play with the idea of love being more complex and relationships being complex and there being a sense of honor and duty to a person and how they interact with the world and rewarded. How do I say it? It's the Horatio Hornblower story, so you know what it is, but if you understand that. But there was this theme of an honorable person living their world and being sort of rewarded for it. They're punished for being honorable, and yet they keep their honor by acting in a certain way. I'm saying, drink it if I say honor 100 times.
She's named appropriately, we'll say that. I've heard it described once as competence porn, because especially in some of the earlier books, there is a running theme that Honor and all of her friends and allies are competent and always double check their things and wind up winning because of it, and their enemies are all incompetent and just kind of wade in happy and fat and make terrible mistakes. And if you like competence porn and military sci-fi stuff and a dash of social commentary, the second book, which is actually the place I recommend most people start, the first book's garbage. You can go back and reread it if you find yourself invested.
Wait. Basilisk Station, the one where she is stuck doing a shitty assignment because she pissed off the wrong person?
That's the first one. The second one is after she's sort of rehabilitated herself politically through great heroism and honor and competence and all that other bullshit. Has to go on a mission where she's escorting a bunch of civilians and a bunch of technology and stuff being brought to a backwater nation called Grayson, whose gimmick is that they're kind of space-ish Mormons. They like. Back when, global warming and pollution and everything presumably got as worse than it is now, way worse, like people are looking to leave the planet worse, they said, fuck it, we're just gonna go fly off to some place in the middle of nowhere. They found a nice little planet, stuck themselves in cryo tubes, and flew off with the explicit goal of living a life more in tune with nature and with less technology. So, like, space Amish type people, maybe?
That's part of it, and then when they got there, they kind of discovered the downside of shooting yourself into space without checking things, arrived on the planet and it turns out to be toxic to human life.
Heavy metals in concentrations just high enough for them to barely survive, but too high for them to, like, really recover or survive, made worse by the fact that they didn't feel like actually keeping much technology when they went over.
And then the folks had to survive by restoring some of the technology that they had run away from.
When we meet them, they build giant domes in space and, like, inch by inch reclaim ground as aggressively as they can so that they can just eke out a life. And they're incredibly primitive and they're very backwards because, Honor Harrington is a woman in a society that it's just a baseline. Yes, of course she's a girl. What's the problem here? We're way past that bullshit. Meanwhile, they are at a stage where women really don't have a lot of rights on paper,
Okay.
and the place is very misogynistic. And then their enemies are like, them on extreme steroids and even more misogynistic. And the whole thing winds up an interesting sort of discussion over the series on the soul of Grayson and, what they can do better and be better and integrate women more. And why they are a society that can manage that while their enemies who've split off from them onto another planet just fundamentally cannot. And it's really, 90s, but still not bad.
Dragon, I always thought of that whole Grayson stuff as the 90s conservative answer to feminism.
Really?
Yeah, this isn't a knock to David Weber himself, but what he did was find a way to create a palatable answer for conservatives. Why should we let women have rights? Because it's a test. The world is a test. All things are a test. And if we meet the test, blah, 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 blah. Okay, look, I'm pretty uncharitable when it comes to that particular theme, because the way it's developed, it's very forgiving of conservatism and the kind of attitudes that are rooted in this. And I don't, this isn't a political thing, this is just the social conservatism. And a lot of the choices made, it sort of waved off because, oh, there were circumstances that required hard choices, and those hard choices require us to do hard things, like, in order to survive on this world, our women had to have lots of babies, and they were so vulnerable, so we had to protect them. And the only way we could protect them was, like, there are entire passages that use the same social conservative language, but frame it in a way where it's, this is all the choices they had, so clearly they, and if they are given other choices, suddenly everything will be better.
Yeah, that is fairly uncharitable. Honestly, I would call it uncharitable to the point that it's kind of misreading the wider series a little. One of the core themes of especially this book, but a lot of just the Honorverse stuff in general, is that you can't largely set aside morality when just because it's inconvenient. It happens even in this book when Honor is on the verge of literally extrajudicially murdering a POW, who quite frankly deserved it, but it was important that you don't just shoot somebody. You give them the trial, you go through these motions because of what it is about you and who you are. When Grayson was forced to make their hard choices and go about their hard deeds, they made wrong choices, and they suffer for it, almost literally in this externalized way from the Mossadans, who are sort of the primary enemies of this book, and their aggressive, religious, hyper-conservative offshoot that actively wants to come back and murder them all. It is a core theme, right, that you have to do better, and you have to confront that past to do better, which is also something this book is about. A lot of the characters who are shown to be progressive or able to see that progressive angle and move forward have to confront that past and understand that whether it looked like a good idea or not at the time, it was the wrong call.
I think we got a little bit lost, but the series itself is a lot of fun. It's good guys versus bad guys, and who the good guys are changes over the course of the series. Who the bad guys are gets changed by the series as well. And you get to, if you're a military buff or you enjoy just like oceanic travels and military folks talking to each other and skullduggery and a lot of other things, the entire series is fairly good. Although at this point, I've lost complete track of it because David Weber writes like 40 different series, but somehow doesn't seem to match the same quality for every series. So at this point, I'm like.
He does not, and even some of the later Honorverse books are a little how would I put this? Loaded.
It's because he couldn't end the series. The main series should have ended at a certain point. Even he admitted in interviews that he had a plan to end the series then, but then, money and time, and he was like, okay, I'll just go keep writing.
So the plan wasn't to end the series. The plan was at a specific moment, and if you everybody ever bothers to read it, you'll know it when you see it, to kill Honor off and then follow the story from like the perspective of her heirs and so on after a time skip. Somebody, I want to say it was Eric Flint, convinced him that was a bad idea and not to do so, and then helped step in and co-wrote a side series with a man named Victor Cashett, the most egalitarian man in the world. And those are okay, and the story is just kind of okay after that. He should have stuck with his first instinct, personally, but that's just me.
Okay, but yeah, that's the honor. I don't think we did a good job of selling the series too much, I hope.
It's one of those things where I don't know how hard I want to sell it, because if it's not for you, then it's really not for you. But if any of this sounds like it is for you, do check it out.
It could be. It is worth giving a shot. I'm gonna pick something a little bit more like current. Because one of the things I'll talk about this is that I saw I was reading a Reddit post on R Fantasy, and they were talking about like how their particular likes are not part of the top 200 fantasy novels, epic novels on R Fantasy. And the conversation kind of shifted to the point that a lot of what R Fantasy likes has been the same thing for 20 years,
True.
the same epic fantasy, the same. Structural stories, the same group of dudes and one or two women, and it's because there is a solid pushback on anything new being introduced or any other structures or anything else happening. And that's partly, at least in my opinion, a generational divide, right? The same folks who started in fantasy in the 90s are still the same folks who are around and talking on Reddit now, except they haven't really tried new stuff or have any interest in new stuff. Meanwhile, all of these kids, like me, who grew up in the late 90s, 2000s, we read stuff like Tamora Pierce and, yes, Harry Potter from She Who Will Not Be Named. And our fantasy experiences are different because we were on Tumblr and we went to fantastic fiction and all that, and our development and how we see fantasy is vastly different. And it's a true generational divide. And it's a crying shame that neither side can see the others. Because I see it, and I enjoy both sides of it. This is all to lead into my choice for this week, which I'll keep reasonably short. So there is a writer I love named Seanan McGuire. Seanan McGuire started in like the 2000s. She also writes as Neera Grant. She writes a lot of horror in addition to fantasy. She's a bunch of different series. She's a very prolific writer, and one of the things she's written in the last 6 or 7 years is a series called, well, it starts with a short novel named Every Heart a Doorway. It starts out off about the school that exists somewhere, and it's for kids who go through these magic doors to other worlds and then come back to our world, but they want to go back to where they belong. And when they come out of these magic doors from these other worlds, they are changed. So for the protagonist in that particular novel is a girl who finds a door that leads her to a world where it's sort of like Tartarus slash death, and there's the king and queen of death, and everybody's is obsessed with stillness and death and kind of becoming living statues. And she grew up there. She was a little kid when she got lost behind the door. And then when she was older, when she was 16, and she acclimated to the world and she'd become part of it, another door opened and she was pushed through and sent back to the human normal world. And her parents were like shocked that she's back and they don't know where she's from and don't know what to do with her. So they ship her off to the school, and the school is filled with kids just like that. And there's a headmistress and all this. I can't describe any more of the plot or too much of the descriptions of the characters because it's all spoilery, but it is a painful and real exploration of what it means to want something different from the world, want to be different from the world. And I think of it as a really good allegory for queerness, for transness, for being the outsider. And then you find where you belong, and then when you go back and they still don't see you. Like your parents don't necessarily want the person that you are or that you become. They want something else. And who your family is and what you want out of the world and who you want to be. And it's such a really, really great book, and it makes me feel seen in a way that not a lot of works do. It might not appeal to everybody, but if you ever have a chance, check out Every Heart a Doorway by Seanan McGuire.
That sounds familiar too. I'm gonna have to check that out.
Yeah.
I think I've heard somebody else recommend that before.
It deserves more attention than it's getting, and that's okay. I mean, Seanan McGuire isn't everyone's cup of tea. Seanan is actually very much like Pirate in that when they start out with characters, you kind of hate them. She starts out with a character, and like her primary series that everybody knows her for is the Toby Day series, which is about Faye. And the primary character in the first book is such a bitch on purpose. I mean, she's pretty damaged at the start, and she's basically real. Oh my God! She's Ryoka.
I'm not familiar with the story, so I can't comment, but you have the sound of a man who just had a deep revelation about the universe.
Okay, let's get back to fucking TWI. I mean, I need a moment to like sit with this. Let's get back. So what's the chapters we're doing this week?
We're going to be doing a couple magnificent chapters wherein Aaron and Magnolia finally meet. This is what I like to call the immovable force and the unstoppable object.
I remember reading these chapters for the first time, and I was absolutely delighted because I love Magnolia, and unlike a lot of folks, and yes, I am making a generalization, screw you. Unlike a lot of folks, I did not see Magnolia as an antagonist. I saw Magnolia as a skilled person with very different goals from everyone else, and who doesn't see a reason why her goals should be stopped just because you don't like it. And that's who she was, and she presented herself as such, and that's how I always took her. A lot of folks, instead, I think they put her as like the anti-Eren, and I don't know why. To this day, I still don't understand.
I kind of get it. I don't know if I could like specifically describe why, but it makes sense why you might say that. At this point in the story especially, I just wasn't sure if she was going to be ultimately antagonistic or not. And these chapters sort of felt like the chance to have the main character and her bounce off of each other. And I really liked the way Erin felt like she was kind of rising to the challenge. Before she even met Magnolia, she was just riding along in this carriage, lightly snacking on the charcuterie board, and just making conversation with and winning over Renald, who is also an absolute Chad, one of my favorite characters in the whole story.
I mean, yeah, this was the first introduction of Renald the Butler, who, by the way, Leonette tries to demand that she be taken to Magnolia, and he's like, fuck you, no.
You're not on the list, man. No. Reynold would never say fuck you. He would politely let you know that you are not on the invitation list and then arch an eyebrow that lets you know that he's insane, fuck you. But he's too polite to say fuck you.
Yeah, that's definitely true, but that's high class, fuck you.
Yeah, I mean, presumably the ability to give people high-class middle fingers is just like a class feature for most butlers.
It's gotta be. Reynold is charmed by Eren because, I don't know, at this point, Pirate Abel was establishing that Eren can charm anybody. And she meets him on his level, gets in front of the carriage and sits with him and talks with him because she's compelled to do that. She's one of those folks who does that.
Yeah.
And she displays a level of respect for Reynold. And later, when she meets, okay, I'm gonna give you a full 2 minutes to talk about Ressa, and after that, you cannot simp at all.
I'm not much of a Ressa simp. I think you have me confused for someone else.
I'm just checking because I have had too many dudes simp for Ressa. I don't. It's something to do with the fact that she's a maid and she is strict.
Yes, there is definitely a I'm gonna say subsection, but I don't even know if it's a subsection. It's probably a majority at this point of guys for whom stern Victorian maid who is also a badass and can beat you to death is probably some kind of fetish. It isn't mine, but I've seen the same people you have, Oshi. It's just a thing, and you know what? One day we're gonna meet a certain character, and I'm just gonna have to give you the same warning.
Look,
2 minutes. Finish your simping, and then we're done.
my simping is rare and deserve it. Anyway, so there's literally a line in chapter 37 where Pirate writes, "She was flanked by two other women dressed like English maids or dot 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 Japanese cosplayers." I think Pirate Abba likes the maids.
It definitely is a point of reference, though. Nowadays, when you think of like the French maid outfit, people think more of Japan than they think of France.
Honestly, yeah, because maid cafes are such a huge thing in Japan. It's great. I mean, Pirate likes to do their references, but what I found odd was that Aaron knew the reference.
Yeah. And I do appreciate, though, that Aaron is not particularly intimidated by Ressa, despite Ressa being clearly stated and, like, in the prose coming across as very intimidating. And I appreciate just. She plays it off as obliviousness, but nobody can be that oblivious.
I don't know. All I know is that the Ressa scene leads up to one of the introduction to useless group of humans.
Ah, the shitters.
I call them the Ugg. And I'm telling you, it stuck with me forever. And we are introduced to Joseph, Imani, and all these folks who Magnolia has kindly taken into her home. And who are all college students, and I am not going to be charitable in any way. They're dicks.
Yeah. And I understand, right? I don't have no sympathy for them. These are people who are trapped in a truly inconceivable situation, forced to contend with something beyond all reason, and who have then been sort of picked up and sheltered and given the worst of both ways this can go from the way Magnolia have brought them in and kind of smothered them. And they're wallowing. There's no other way for me to describe it. They're wallowing like a bunch of namby-pamby college kids who've never had to hold a real job in their life.
That's perfectly fine. Doesn't miss. Two things can be true. They can be a useless group of humans, and they can also be all the stuff that you just said. I'm gonna stick with being petty and just call them the Ugg.
I'm gonna say they're useless because of the stuff that I've said, except for one of them. One person in this group gets a clear and concise pass. Krellers.
Imani. Yeah. Oh my god. The poor girl. Like, when you suffer that, like, she's the only one who just genuinely is like, fuck this world, understands the level of danger, and instead of like wallowing, she just breaks down. And actually, that's a good thing for me.
Yeah, and I will say though that this is a fun little thing where they're like, "Oh, we're in a video game world. Let's start planning out our classes and levels. I want to do this. I want to do that." And I'm like, "Yeah, this is kind of like those VR games. Everyone says they want them, and then they realize that it's cardio."
It's cool. But the reason I to go back to why I was talking about Imani being like, the thing is, she's facing her trauma constantly. She's experiencing trauma. It's terrible that she has to do it, but at least she's facing her trauma instead of avoiding it or avoiding the implications of the world or pulling a Ryoka. All of those things are not happening. It's just Imani being someone who has experienced terror, genuinely facing that terror and living with it day to day. And I think that's brave. I know that people will say, well, she breaks down and she can't do anything. Fuck you. I mean, if you had to.
You have to break down.
Yeah.
So that's severe, like PTSD, and like I would say shock, but shock doesn't usually last for what's implied to be months. Because if I'm remembering correctly, she would be like ASDF from the call, right? The person screaming about attacking Krellers.
Yeah. So she's the one who's begging for help. It takes decades for people to get over a single assault. A little bit of back history. I was, physically assaulted when I was younger, and that took 12 years for me to get over. I still flinched in certain circumstances. And it's just, I can't believe she deals with it as well as she does.
Yeah, and like breaking down and going through that is kind of an important part of the process. Like with the amount of trauma she's had, it'd be nicer if they had proper, therapists, but you can only expect so much from a world with a class system that you assume would maybe have therapists. I don't know. It's weird to me.
So there's a little plot hole here. Spoilers for anybody who. This isn't a major spoiler, but it's a little thing. There are specific classes and specific objects that help deal with psychic and. Well, I don't mean psychic, I mean mental trauma to manage it, to process it properly. I felt it was odd that Magnolia did not provide that for Imani. Or maybe she did, but it's not shown here.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was a deliberate choice on Pirate Abba's part.
Okay, so there are three things that I can think of that really could help with this that we know of in the setting. One would be somebody with like the mind healer class who are generally presented as being not that great. Anytime I feel like we see somebody with the class healer, we're kind of being presented people that are flailing with limited knowledge. There is stuff like calming draughts and potions, which I could see Magnolia just not wanting to provide due to Magnolia's deal with it philosophy, which arguably, from what we see with another character and more recent stuff, might not be the wrong call. And the third is, I'll just like a minor spoiler here, the class exists.
But the point being, I did find that a disturbing lack on the second read-through. It's a minor point, but I felt that it was something that Harry could have at least engaged with and thought about. But maybe the reason they did it was because they had just quit their job. So the author note for this chapter is that Pirate literally, Muse, I am done with my job. I finished my last days, walked out, and I'm now a full-time writer. June 18th, 2017 was when they became a full-time writer.
And it definitely has worked out.
It is the thing that Pirate did, and I think this is also when Pirate has like an official typo channel and all that stuff, and they were genuinely engaging with things, and I didn't find any commentary. I'll say this though, someone immediately said that was Joseph a JoJo reference.
He's not cool enough to be a JoJo reference.
I don't think so.
I am now persistently, though, wondering, like, if it's possible to bullshit a stand through the class system. There's got to be one in there somewhere. If I ever get dropped into the Wandering Inn, I'm just going to experiment in meditation and trying to summon my soul to punch people with my punch ghost with weird, awkward powers. It'll be beautiful, and I'll die.
Someone did mention something like in the comments that I hadn't thought of, was that Erin in the conversation with the Ugg, she was awkward with them because she couldn't connect with the dude's sort of childish naivete, and it kind of was a strong juxtaposition between Erin's understanding of the world and what their understanding of the world was, and that was a really good writing tool, I think, on Pirate's part, and I didn't want to mention that.
Yeah.
Okay, 38, chapter 38. Let's talk about that one, because that one's the big one for me. Erin plays chess with Magnolia.
Yeah, and I love the imagery of Erin as she's remembering sort of that incident with the dragon and this feeling like she's staring at one in Magnolia, and it all sort of interconnects in an interesting way, and I think speaks more to Magnolia than is really. It's deep. Deeper than it seems initially.
Chess is a metaphor for how Pirate, sorry, not Pirate, Erin thinks about different personalities has come up in a recent chapter. It took a long time for us to get that explicitly out there, Pirate. But Erin does think of each person that she interacts with in terms of how they would play chess, right? So I think Magnolia was described as a little bit too single-minded. She's not as flexible with her plans. She sort of goes all in, does her thing, and she succeeds because she has so much power and ability, right? In this chapter, we see something of a demonstration of her going all in a little bit, in that she uses her skills and abilities to try to win the game and to try to force Eren into her, like, staying and being that. And we see what happens when that kind of all-in play is, I don't know, dodged or outmaneuvered by something unexpected. In this case, Eren's ability to use chess as a visualization and to beat her skills, right?
Yeah, and through, like, the chess game, we have seen it before when Magnolia uses her charm skill and sort of that pink text. But in this, it only comes across as sort of like a bolder, slightly brighter, maybe at least it is on my screen, text, until finally, like, Eren just kind of tells Magnolia to go fuck herself. Because at least I'm noticing moments where the text randomly gets sort of bolder, and it's in moments where it seems like Magnolia would be using her charm. So, that's just me.
I mean, colored text comes back into play, so you know exactly when she's using her skills, right?
Yeah.
And you do see the limits of Eren's abilities as well, because she, when pink text comes into play, she doesn't sense it, right? So there are limits to her stubbornness, her abilities. She can't tell that she's being truth stone, so to speak, but she can tell that she's being manipulated when the game isn't right. And it demonstrates the weaknesses of skills as well. Because when you think about it, one is like a passive sense of it like tests the person, and the other is an actual effect on the person. And those skills can be beaten while other skills have to be detected some way. It's a lot of subtle information that's dropped about how the skill system works, if you're paying attention.
Yeah, and I like the way that this chapter sort of sits in two halves, the initial polite section and then the Eren has had enough section.
It eventually does, like, she does eventually say no. And the fact that she, like, drips other people in tea or something, I love that. It was so hilarious when she, like, went, no! And the tea went flying and everybody got dripped.
Yeah. I do like that Eren's response to, oh, you can mind read me while we're playing chess? Oh, no, keep doing it. It's an interesting thing. You're awful, though. You can actually see what I'm going to do next and I'm still kicking your ass. Eren doesn't actually say that last part, but it's implied.
Yeah, and I do like that this chapter sort of lays out on the table why Magnolia can't work with Eren, and it's literally the Antinium. Because even if the Antinium are kind, nice, and individuals, she still can't work with Eren because the Antinium are both the only way that she sees to, like, bring people together on this continent and stop the evil stuff, like the war, the constant wars, and also a true threat to the peace of Israel. And Magnolia lays out that matters to her more than any individual, bringing peace in whatever means necessary kind of situation.
The Antinium are her boogeyman, right? And we've got the Antinium Wars episodes coming up soon, and we get a look just kind of how heinous they are and were. We can even see it from what little we see of their internal politics that, like, maybe Magnolia is not wrong to distrust them as a group. Individuals, clearly, are all, you know, individual people, and no one is a monolith. But does no one as a monolith apply when you're talking about a species with, like, a top-down hierarchical organization where 99% of them have no personality?
And Magnolia says that even if Eren develops these individuals, she can't take the risk. And truly, this is an echo of the same arguments she has for... I think we've had these arguments about goblins, right? Individuals could be great, you could have tribes and stuff, but that doesn't change the inherent nature of what the species or what this political group or what the social group represent. And this is the juxtaposition between the two arguments. Those who seek the individualistic approach, where they're like, we can't judge an entire group this way, we have to be fair about it. And then there's a group that says, it's not about fairness, what's important is peace and prosperity, and the group as it is right now does not seek that. Their goals are inherently opposed to what we're doing and what we're trying to accomplish. Both sides are not wrong, but they're also.
The risk is just so high.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of God, it was one of the almost good lines in Batman v Superman, where Batman's like, "Oh yeah, if there's like a 99, if there's like a 1% chance that Superman wants to end the human race, we have to plan for it because if he does, he can. It's a certainty. We just have to stop it ahead of time."
He could literally go pick out an asteroid or a bunch of asteroids and push them into the planet, and we'd all die.
Actually, fuck, there is a great comic book series called Irredeemable that really kind of is that plot line.
It
The
is.
guy who's been running around being Superman has, an emotional breakdown because it turns out being Superman is hard, and proceeds to declare himself king and sink Puerto Rico.
Oh. I mean, it's not the only one. There's been lots of, like, in the last, I think, decade.
It is, in my mind, the best ones, which is why I bring it up. Also, I think I've been seeing its Kickstarter a bunch, so it might just be subliminal advertising sitting in my brain.
The Boys is also a good recent adaptation of the superheroes who are internally incapable of dealing with the consequences of what their powers and what they are represent.
Yeah, it's on a different wavelength than what we're talking about, though, I guess.
True, but I wanted to mention it because I saw a clip of something. So there, oh God, I don't think I should describe this, and but there's a scene at the start of Boys season 3. So there's a guy named Termite Man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you've seen it, right?
Everybody knows the scene you're talking about, and if they don't, they're sweet summer children who should not Google this. But I will say, that scene definitely reminded me that for all that the Boys TV show is much better at, like, telling a coherent story and having great themes, the comic book did shocking moments better.
Yeah, I think so.
The comic book, the guy writing it had what I will call a deep-seated, seething hatred for the concept of superheroes and a contempt for the entire material that definitely spiced up some of the shit that he wrote.
I mean, when you think about it, a lot of what is consequential, you just know, when it comes to superheroes, it's just never explored. It's sort of hand-waved. It's just like the evolution of culture. We don't really examine the people that we admire. So we had the different eras of comics where as we started like deconstructing the superhero traits and why superheroes exist and are they human beings and do we treat them as idols? Are they one note who says a bunch of catchphrases or are they people? And we're now in the era where the superheroes are not untouchable anymore. We have to engage with them as people. I love that scene because despite its shocking nature at the end. Before that, it was an interesting exploration of where society is in terms of just like dealing with the fact that superpower people are people first and foremost, and superpowered like third or fourth. And they will do things, and because they're humans, they will do weird sex things.
Yeah, but oh God, the story though here, I've been kind of percolating this, trying to compare Aaron and Magnolia, and I think the way I would describe it is that Aaron will sacrifice the idea of a long-term perfect solution. Aaron wants the perfect solution that is now,
Yes.
right? She looks at the Antinium, she looks at the goblins, she says, "These are people, and right now, immediately, we have to deal with that." And Magnolia wants the perfect solution long term that says whether or not they're people or not is irrelevant. I'm trying to create the lasting peace, the lasting solution.
I don't agree because I think what Aaron seeks is principled solutions, where Magnolia seeks societal solutions. Magnolia wants a better world. Aaron wants a better world too, but Aaron wants that better world to come today, here, and now, and she thinks it can come if everybody sticks to being good guys and not bad guys. And Magnolia sees it as, and you get those good guys by giving everybody a chance to be a good guy. And if you just give everybody a chance and you can just give them the ability to try and give them a second chance and take that risk, then you'll get more back than you will lose. And Magnolia is of the opinion that that does not work. You can't just give people a chance because the risk, the damage to the world is greater than whatever you could. Maybe if she was thinking about in terms of my friend or my thing, but she's lived a world where, like, she's thinking about it in a personal sense, but she thinks about it in a societal sense. If House Reinhardt tried to give somebody like the Assassin's Guild a chance, a second chance, and they stabbed House Reinhardt in the back and House Reinhardt died, that's thousands of people are dead, society is ruined just because they took a risk and gave a chance. She can't do that on that scale. For her, it's about, I will take on the pain, I will take on the damage, I will let everybody hate me. Because at the end of the day, all I want is for society to be in a place where people like you get to make those choices, but the damage isn't going to destroy the world. And for Aaron, it's like, I want to be able to make those choices now because those choices will lead to the better world you're talking about. And I believe that, and I truly think that that's possible. And I think the fact that you don't give people a chance is wrong, and that's why you can't achieve your goal. And that's the philosophical differences that I see. Sorry, I took it over, but I really feel strongly about this.
I mean, no, I get what you're saying. I don't know if I agree with Magnolia not being willing to give people chances. She seems pretty clearly willing to give people a chance. She's just not willing to give them a second chance.
Yes, I should. Yeah, I'm talking about a second chance. Like, she's not willing to extend the hand and be like, yeah. And then once you make the mistake, that's it. You're done. You're gut. You're garbage. I'm not gonna go back.
I loved the clash between them. I was so like just proud and happy with Aaron in this moment, in this whole like exchange back and forth. The way that she just won't be bullied. And also the fact that at the end of the day, Magnolia is like, well, when Aaron came in, Magnolia was judging her kind of by the standards of the UGG.
I mean, that's all she had as an
Yeah.
experience base for like you and Ryoka, who ran away from her because she's a paranoid idiot.
She's paranoid whether or not she, well, she's also an idiot, but whether she's a, well, she, yes, she is a paranoid idiot, but in the context of Magnolia, she might have a point.
She didn't know that. Oh, come on. Like, you know I'm not wrong. Stop arguing with me.
The way that Aaron just exceeds her expectations kind of throws her offers and her condescension back in her face, and then says, "Oh, and I gotta go back to my fucking inn now. I have a job to run." And honestly, the only thing missing here was her saying, "Oh, and can you get your shitty cousin out of my inn?" But Aaron is too kind for that. She is all on that second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth chance wagon.
Yeah, and the big thing is for this chapter, Pirate ends it on, I think it's a little clunky. The theme is good, but the execution is clunky. And it's all about asking Aaron the question of what will you do? What do you plan to do? What will you do if you leave this place? What are you gonna do with it in this new world? And the last sequence is just a bunch of live the world, save the world, run away, ask for help. And then it ends on the sequence save the world. I don't know. I didn't love it. I didn't love it. What did you think?
I thought it was great.
Oh, okay. That's all we need to hear, I guess.
Like, Erin has been, at the core of herself, challenged by Magnolia, right? Like, at the end of the day, this is a deep clash of deeply held ideals, and what I like about Erin is she doesn't just bluster through that. She stops. She has to think about the real consequences that can come from all of these things that are beyond her, and she decides that she's just gonna fucking save the world. And I like that because it's not the normal isekai protagonist told they need to save the world. She has lived in this world, she's met its people, she's grown to love some of them, and she has decided she's going to do everything she can to fix it. Also, yes, her class is still innkeeper, right? I think that there is something fascinating there, and it might have been a bit clumsy in how it got there, but I love it.
So you agree it's clumsy.
I think that it is a little teensy tiny bit clumsy. I don't think it's terribly clumsy. Like, I think that it knew where it wanted to go, and I liked it a lot.
Okay, I'm gonna stick with it was clumsy in execution, but good in thematic resonance. And we'll just leave it at that. And then, like, Pirate is talking about how they're now a full-time writer and they're complaining about complexity and plot significance and all the things that they want to and how hard Magnolia is to write. That's one of the things I always feel like writers don't necessarily, I don't know if they talk about it a lot, maybe they don't, but when they come to certain characters, especially for writers who are like big on characterization, certain characters are just difficult for them to write, so they avoid doing it. And that can contribute to a kind of lack of depth. Not because they write it badly, but because they just don't engage with the topic that often, right?
Yeah, no, it can be hard to write outside your experience in some ways. It's a complicated subject with a whole lot of complicated complications. I don't know. It's one that can get pretty fraught if you dig too deep into it, so I'm trying to stay general.
Yeah, it is a little draw. So there's a bunch of commentary from Pirate in the comments specifically about their monetary goals and their reactions to the chapter, but I don't think we should talk too much about it because it makes me uncomfortable to talk about this stuff. I don't know why, it just does. I just don't want to talk. But I will say that this chapter generated a lot of commentary, especially back and forth over Magnolia. And Magnolia remains to this day one of the more controversial figures. I don't know why, but she does.
She's controversial because she's deliberately written to be controversial, Oshi. I don't know what's.
Are you sure about that? Because I've never felt like she was written to be controversial.
I do. I feel like Pirate has wanted us to constantly be guessing, is she being totally honest with her stuff when she talks to Ryoka? Is she trying to manipulate or use Ryoka? Is she well-meaning? Is she trying to grab political power? Is all of this just a front? She's really deeply a cynical political realpolitik maneuverer. I think that Pirate wants us to have a degree of what is Magnolia's deal at this point. I think that this is maybe when we first get a real look to like who she is behind the curtain, but she's definitely not meant to be a simple, straightforward character that everybody agrees on.
Okay. On that note of not being a straightforward character, let's end the podcast. Okay, that's a terrible segue, but that's the best I got right now.
I mean, okay, on the subject of things that are straightforward, it is about time for us to cut this off because we are running into our time limit. Actually, we're on like a great spot on our time limit. We're only 7 minutes over.
I know. I told you I'm keeping track. I'm keeping pace. I'm trying to move things along. I'm getting better at this. I'm just saying. Okay. I should mention one other thing. We're going to be changing things up coming up in Volume 3. We might actually take a week or two off to build up a little bit of a backlog. And the idea for Volume 3 is we're going to go away from the covering like a couple of chapters at a time per episode. And instead, we're going to talk about arcs. And we'll talk about characters, arcs, things that happen, and we'll talk about the events, and we'll cover them over a couple of episodes. This way, we're able to cover more of the volume, and we're experimenting with it in this way because we need to like adjust for the length of the Wandering Inn. Otherwise, we're going to be doing this forever. Plus, I think both of us want to talk about other stuff along with the Wandering Inn, right?
I mean, I just like to hear my own voice. I'm a narcissist like that.
I do not, and that's why we have other editors.
Yeah, I can't actually stand the sound of my own voice. I it's a problem.
Okay, so on that note, look out for Volume 3. It's going to come up in a couple weeks. We're going to change it up. Tell us what you think about it when it does. And everybody, go check out Pirate Abba's AMA with Andrea Parsnow. Go buy The Reigns of L'Escaure. Go buy merch. By the time this comes out, the merch store is out. I bought the Consequences hoodie. I love that shit. And it went to the wrong address because I couldn't write it down properly and I had to beg them to change it.
I ran into a problem where someone in Ontario decided they needed $80 worth of Tim Hortons and tried to use my card to do it. So I've missed pretty much all of my chances to try and get a hold of some of this stuff. So it's just going to have to wait. By the time I have my new card and some money back, I am hoping that it isn't all sold out.
Oh my god, no, I think from what, okay, it'll be public. So there's only one thing that's sort of limited in scope that they can produce. It's the cast iron pan, which apparently sold very well because like when the Patreon launch happened, it sold out in 30 minutes, and then the timer, like the thing went up saying that it sold out.
Yeah.
Apparently people like cast iron pans.
I cook almost exclusively with cast iron. I love it. I probably would just buy that as a showpiece, though. I'd feel bad actually cooking on it. I know it can be.
I wouldn't. if I'm buying something like that, if I'm buying something for $150, I'm gonna use it. It's not gonna be a showpiece. It's gonna be something that I interact with every single day. It's something that reminds me of whatever the hell it is. And it has to be something that's well made. And so far as I can tell, it is exactly all those three things. So I'm definitely using that cast iron pan once I buy it, if it comes back into stock and whatnot, which will be December for me anyway, because I'm buying it as a Christmas present for myself. Even though I don't celebrate Christmas, it's still going to be a Christmas present.
Yeah, no, that's the weird thing about Christmas. It's kind of a secular holiday while also being a religious holiday, and who needs Jesus if just you want shit, right?
Okay, thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.